The Gulag Archipelago, 1918 to 1956. An experiment in literary investigation by Alexander I. Solzhenitsyn. Translated by Thomas P. Whitney. Copyright 1973 by Alexander I. Solzhenitsyn. English language translation, copyright 1973-1974 by Harper and Row Publishers, Incorporated. This recording of the reading of the Gulag Archipelago was published by arrangement with Harper and Row Publishers, Incorporated, and was produced in 1989 by Blackstone Audio Books, which holds the copyright thereto. Neither this recording nor any part thereof may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authority from Blackstone Audio Books, Incorporated. The Gulag Archipelago, Volume 2. This volume is 672 pages long and contains two parts: The Destructive Labor Camps, which consists of 22 chapters, and The Soul and Barbed Wire, which consists of 4 chapters. The volume is read in 2 sections. The first took us through Chapter 9 of The Destructive Labor Camps. The second picks up with Chapter 10 and takes us to the end of Volume 2. And now, The Gulag Archipelago, Volume 2, Section 2.
Chapter 10. In Place of Politicals. But in that grim world where everyone gnawed up whomever he could, where a human's life and conscience were bought for a ration of soggy bread, in that world who and where were the politicals, bearers of the honour and the torch of all the prison populations of history? We have already traced how the original politicals were divided, stifled, and exterminated. And in their place? Well, what did take their place? Since then we have had no politicals, and we could not possibly have any. What kind of politicals could we have if universal justice had been established? Once upon a time in the Tsarist prisons we put to good use the special privileges of the politicals, and as a result came to realize all the more clearly that they had to be abolished. They simply abolished the politicals. There are none, and there won't be any. And as for those who were imprisoned, well, they were KRs, enemies of the revolution. As the years passed, the word revolution itself faded. Very well, then, let them be enemies of the people. That sounded even better. If, basing ourselves on our review of the waves, we count the numbers imprisoned under this article, and add 3 times that number for the members of their families, banished, suspected, humiliated, and persecuted, then we shall be forced to admit to our astonishment that for the first time in history the people had become its own enemy, though in return it acquired the best of friends, the secret police. There is a famous camp anecdote about a sentenced woman who for a long time could not get through her head why the prosecutor and judge at her trial had kept calling her Kolimitsioner, a mounted policeman, which is what she understood of contra-revolutioner, a counter-revolutionary. As one who has served time in camps and looked about, I can see this anecdote as fact. A tailor, laying aside his needle, stuck it into a newspaper on the wall so it wouldn't get lost, and happened to stick it in the eye of a portrait of Kaganovich. A customer observed this. Article 58, 10 years. Terrorism. A saleswoman accepting merchandise from a forwarder noted it down on a sheet of newspaper. There was no other paper. The number of pieces of soap happened to fall on the forehead of Comrade Stalin. Article 58, 10 years. A tractor driver of the Znamenka machinery and tractor station lined his thin shoes for warmth with a pamphlet about the candidate for elections to the Supreme Soviet, but a charwoman noticed it was missing. She was responsible for the leaflets, and found out who had it. KRA, counter-revolutionary agitation, 10 years. The village club manager went with his watchman to buy a bust of Comrade Stalin. They bought it. The bust was big and heavy. They ought to have carried it in a hand barrow, both of them together, but the manager's status did not allow him to. All right, you'll manage it if you take it slowly. And he went off ahead. The old watchman couldn't work out how to do it for a long time. If he tried to carry it at his side, he couldn't get his arm around it. If he tried to carry it in front of him, his back hurt and he was thrown off balance backward. Finally, he figured out how to do it. He took off his belt, made a noose for Comrade Stalin, put it around his neck, and in this way carried it over his shoulder through the village. Well, there was nothing here to argue about. It was an open and shut case. Article 58.8, terrorism, 10 years. A sailor sold an Englishman a Katyusha cigarette lighter, a wick in a piece of pipe with a striking wheel, as a souvenir for £1 sterling. Subversion of the motherland's dignity, 58, 10 years. A shepherd, in a fit of anger, swore at a cow for not obeying. You collective farm, W.H. blank. And he got 58, and a term. Elochka Svirskaya sang a ditty at an amateur concert, which just barely touched on something sensitive, and this was open rebellion. 58, 10 years. A deaf and dumb carpenter got a term for counter-revolutionary agitation. How? He was laying floors in a club. Everything had been removed from a big hall, and there was no nail or hook anywhere. While he was working, he hung his jacket and his service cap on a bust of Lenin. Someone came in and saw it. 58, 10 years. How many of them there were in Volgolag before the war, illiterate old villagers from Tula, Kaluga, and Smolensk provinces. They all had Article 58.10, in other words, anti-Soviet propaganda, because when they had to sign, they made their mark with a cross. This is Loschilin's story. After the war, I did time in camp with a man from Vetluga named Maximov. He had served from the beginning of the war in an anti-aircraft battery. During the winter, their political commissar had assembled them to discuss with them the Pravda lead editorial of January the 16th, 1942. During the winter, we must smash the German so badly that in the spring he will not be able to rise again. He assigned Maximov to speak on this topic, too. The latter said, "That's right. We have to drive him out, the bastard, while the storms are raging, while he has no felt boots, even though we ourselves have ordinary shoes on now and then. But in the spring it's going to be worse because of his equipment." And the political commissar applauded, as if everything was all right. But then Maximov was summoned to Smirsch and had 8 years tied on him for praising German equipment, 58. And Maximov's education had been 1 year at a village school. His son, a Komsomol member, came to camp from the army and ordered him, "Don't write mother you're arrested. Say you're in the army and they won't let you go." His wife wrote back to the P.O. box address, "Your class has all been released. Why don't they let you go?" And the convoy guard looked at Maximov, who was always unshaven and crestfallen, and a bit deaf in addition, and advised him, "So write that you've become an officer, and that's why they're keeping you." Someone at the construction site once got angry at Maximov for his deafness and stupidity, and cursed him out. "They spoiled Article 58 with you." The children in a collective farm club got out of hand, had a fight, and accidentally knocked some poster or other off the wall with their backs. The two eldest were sentenced under Article 58. On the basis of the decree of 1935, children from the age of 12 on had full criminal responsibility for all crimes. They also sentenced the parents for having allegedly told them to and sent them to do it. A 16-year-old Chuvash schoolboy made a mistake in Russian in a slogan in the wall newspaper. It was not his native language. Article 58, 5 years. And in a state farm bookkeeping office, the slogan hung, "Life has become better. Life has become more gay. Stalin." And someone added a letter in red pencil to Stalin's name, making the slogan read as though life had become more gay for Stalin. They didn't look for the guilty party, but sentenced the entire bookkeeping office. Gesell Bernstein and his wife, Beschestnaya, were sentenced to 5 years under 58.10 for holding a spiritualist seance at home. The interrogator kept asking, who else was in on it? There was a rumor in camp that Gesell had been imprisoned for fortune-telling, and the trustees used to bring him bread and tobacco and say, tell my fortune too. Nonsensical? Fantastic? Senseless? It's not at all meaningless, for that is just exactly what terror as a means of persuasion is. There is a proverb, beat the crow and beat the raven, and in the end you'll get to the white swan. Just keep beating one after another, and in the end you'll hit the one you need. The primary meaning of mass terror lies precisely in this. Even the strong and well hidden, who could never be ferreted out, simply will be caught and perish. And what absurd accusations weren't manufactured in order to provide a foundation for the arrest of random or marked individuals? The charge against Grigory Yefimovich Generalov from Smolensk province was that he used to drink heavily because he hated the Soviet government. And actually, he used to drink heavily because he and his wife got along badly. He got 8 years. Irina Chuchinskaya, the fiancée of Sofronitsky's son, was arrested while leaving church. The intention was to arrest their whole family. And she was charged with having prayed in church for the death of Stalin. Who could have heard that prayer? Terrorism? 25 years? Alexander Babich was accused of having in 1916 acted against the Soviet government while serving in the Turkish army. In actual fact, he had been a Russian volunteer on the Turkish front, and he was additionally charged with the intent of turning over to the Germans in 1941 the icebreaker Sadko, on which he was a passenger. And the sentence was to be shot. They replaced it with a 10-ruble bill, and he died in camp. Sergei Stepanovich Fyodorov, an artillery engineer, was charged with wrecking by slowing down the projects of young engineers. You see, these Komsomol activists do not have any leisure time in which to complete their drawings. And nonetheless, this desperate wrecker was taken straight from the Kresty prison to war factories as a consultant. Corresponding member of the Academy of Sciences, Ignatovsky, was arrested in Leningrad in 1941 and accused of having been recruited by the German intelligence service when he was working for Zeiss in 1908. And he was supposed to have had a very strange assignment, too, not to engage in espionage in the coming war, which was, of course, the center of interest of that generation of the intelligence services, but only in the next one. And therefore he had loyally served the Tsar in World War I, and then the Soviet government also, and had put into operation the only optical factory in the country, GOMZ, and been elected to the Academy of Sciences, and then, at the beginning of World War II, he had been caught, rendered harmless, and shot. However, for the most part, fantastic accusations were not really required. There existed a very simple, standardized collection of charges, from which it was enough for the interrogator to pick one or two and stick them, like postage stamps, on an envelope. Discrediting the leader, a negative attitude toward the collective farm structure, a negative attitude toward state loans, and what normal person could have had a positive attitude, a negative attitude toward the Stalinist constitution, a negative attitude toward whatever was the immediate, particular measure being carried out by the party, sympathy for Trotsky, friendliness toward the United States, etc., etc., etc. The pasting on of these stamps of varying value was monotonous work, requiring no artistry whatsoever. All the interrogator needed was the next victim in line, so as not to lose time. Such victims were selected on the basis of arrest quotas by security chiefs of local administrative districts, military units, transportation departments, and educational institutions. And so that the security chiefs did not have to strain their brains, denunciations from informers came in very handy. In the conflicts between people in freedom, denunciations were the superweapon, the X-rays. It was sufficient to direct an invisible little ray at your enemy, and he fell. And it always worked. For these cases, I have not recollected the names of the individuals involved, but I can affirm that I heard many stories in imprisonment about the use of denunciation in lovers' quarrels. A man would remove an unwanted husband, a wife would dispose of a mistress, or a mistress would dispose of a wife, or a mistress would take revenge on her lover because she had failed to separate him from his wife. The most frequently used postage stamp was Section 10, counter-revolutionary, subsequently renamed anti-Soviet, agitation. If our descendants should someday read the interrogation and trial records of Stalin's times, they will be utterly astounded to find what indefatigable and adroit operators those anti-Soviet propagandists were. They were quite capable of using a needle or a tattered service cap for propaganda purposes, washed floors, see below, or unwashed linens, a smile or its absence, too expressive or too impenetrable a look, soundless thoughts inside the skull, notes in an intimate diary, love letters, graffiti in toilets. They propagandized on the highways and byways, at a fire, at the collective farm market, in the kitchen, behind the domestic tea table, and in bed, whispering in the ear. And only the invincible social structure of socialism could withstand such a propaganda assault. In the archipelago, they used to love to joke that not all the articles of the criminal code were accessible. One or another person might wish to violate the law on protection of socialist property, but was not allowed near it. Some other person wouldn't hesitate to commit embezzlement, but could not manage to get a job as a cashier. To murder, one had to have at least a knife. To possess a weapon unlawfully, one first of all had to acquire a weapon. To have carnal knowledge of animals, one had to have livestock. Even Article 58 was not so easily accessible. Just how can you betray the motherland under the heading of Section 1B if you don't serve in the army? How can you establish contact with the world bourgeoisie under Section 4 if you live in Khanty-Mansiysk? And how can you subvert state industry and transportation under Section 7 if you work as a barber? If you don't have at least a stinking old sterilizer so it can explode, chemical engineer Chudakov arrested in 1948 for diversionary activities. But Section 10 of Article 58 was universally accessible to aged old women and 12-year-old schoolboys, to married and single, to pregnant women and virgins, to athletes and cripples, to drunk and sober, to those who can see and to the blind, too, to owners of automobiles and beggars of arms. One can earn one's sentence via Section 10 just as readily in the winter as in the summer, on a weekday as on a Sunday, early morning and late at night, at work or at home, on a stair landing, at a metro station, in a dense forest, in an intermission at the theatre, or during the course of a solar eclipse. The only other section which could rival Section 10 in its accessibility was Section 12. Failure to make a denunciation, or he knew but he didn't tell. All those same people listed above could receive this section and in all the same conditions. But the special advantage in this case was that one did not even have to open one's mouth, nor take pen in hand. The whole point of this section was failure to act. And the sentence was the same, 10 years of imprisonment and 5 years muzzled. Of course, after the war, Section 1 of Article 58, treason to the motherland, no longer seemed difficult to attain either. Not only all the POWs, not only all those who had been in occupied territories had a right to it, but even those who had dallied over being evacuated from threatened areas and who thereby disclosed their intent to betray the motherland. Professor of Mathematics Zhuravsky asked for 3 plain seats out of Leningrad, for his wife, his 6 sister-in-law, and himself. They gave him 2, none for the sister-in-law. He sent off his wife and sister-in-law and stayed behind. The authorities could only interpret this act to mean that the professor was waiting for the Germans. Article 58.1a, via 19, 10 years. In comparison with those unfortunates described earlier, the tailor, the club watchman, the deaf and dumb man, the sailor, or the man from Betluga, here are some others whose sentences will seem fully justified. The Estonian Enseld, who arrived in Leningrad from still independent Estonia, had a letter taken from him written in Russian. To whom? From whom? I am an honorable man, and I cannot tell you. The letter was from V. Chernoff to his relatives. Aha! Bastard! So you are an honorable man. So off to Solovki with you. At least he actually did have a letter. Girichevsky, the father of two frontline soldiers, got conscripted into peat digging during the wartime labor mobilization, and he criticized the watery, oversalted soup there. He actually did criticize. He did open his mouth. And quite deservedly, he got 58-10 for this. 10 years. He died picking potato peelings out of the camp slops. In his dirty pocket was a photograph of his son, his chest covered with medals. Nestorovsky was an English language teacher who, in his own home over the tea table, told his wife and her best friend, he really did tell them, how impoverished and hungry were the rear areas on the right bank of the Volga River. Her best friend did in both the Nestorovskys. He got 10 years under Section 10, and she got the same under Section 12. And what about their apartment? I don't know. Perhaps it went to the best friend. N. I. Ryabinin, in 1941, said during our retreat, said aloud where everyone could hear, "We should have sung fewer songs like Don't Touch Us and We Won't Touch You. We'll give no quarter if you do." Well now, a scoundrel like that certainly ought to have been shot at the very least, but they only gave him 10 years. Reunov and Tretyukhin, both communists, got as hot and bothered as if a wasp had stung them on the neck, because the party congress was long overdue, and this was a violation of the statutes. As if it were any of their lousy business. They got 10 each. Faina Yefimovna Epstein, astounded at Trotsky's criminal activity, asked at a party meeting, why was he allowed to leave the USSR? As if the party was answerable to her. And maybe Yosif Vissarionovich was kicking himself about that. For this awkward question, she deservedly got and served out 3 terms, one after another, even though not one of the interrogators or prosecutors could explain to her where her guilt lay. And Grusha the proletarian committed a crime of simply astounding gravity. She worked at a glass factory for 23 years, and her neighbours had never seen an icon in her home. But just before the Germans got to her district, she did put up some icons. She had simply stopped being afraid. After all, they used to persecute people who had icons. And what the interrogation particularly noted on the basis of the denunciation of her neighbours was that she had also washed her floors. But the Germans never did get there. Then, too, she had picked up near her house a pretty German leaflet with a picture and pushed it into the vase on her dresser. And despite all this, our humane court, taking into consideration her proletarian origins, gave Grusha only 8 years of camp and 3 years of disenfranchisement. Meanwhile, her husband perished at the front, and her daughter was a student in the Technological Institute, but the carders kept tormenting her. "Where is your mother?" And the girl poisoned herself. Grusha could never get past the point of her daughter's death in telling her story. She sobbed and went out. And what was Gennady Sorokin, a student in the 3rd year at the Chelyabinsk Pedagogical Institute, to be given for having published 2 of his own essays in a student's literary journal, 1946? Small change, of course, 10 years. And what about reading the poet Sergei Yesenin? After all, we keep forgetting everything. Soon they will be telling us that this was not so. Yesenin was always a revered poet of the people. But Yesenin was a counter-revolutionary poet. His verses were forbidden literature. M.Y. Potapova was charged as follows in the Ryazan State Security. "How did you dare admire Yesenin before the war, if Yosif Vissarionovich said that the best and the most talented was Mayakovsky? That's how your anti-Soviet nature showed itself." And that civil aviation flyer, assistant pilot of a Douglas, looks like a dyed-in-the-wool anti-Soviet. Not only did they find a complete collection of Yesenin in his possession, Not only did he talk about how well-to-do and well-fed people were in East Prussia until we got there, but during the course of a public debate in an aviation unit, he got into a public argument with Ilya Ehrenberg about Germany. In view of Ehrenberg's position at that time, one may conclude that the pilot was proposing gentler treatment of the Germans. In Ehrenberg's memoirs, you will find no trace of such trivial incidents. Anyway, he might not have known that the man arguing with him had been arrested. He merely offered a fairly standard party-line reply at that particular moment, and then forgot about it. Ehrenberg writes that he himself survived by lottery. Well, that little lottery had marked numbers. If they were rounding up your friends, you had to stop phoning them in time. If the wagon shaft turned, it was necessary to turn too. Ehrenberg heated up hatred for the Germans so insanely that Stalin had to pull him up short. If you feel toward the end of your life that you helped establish a lie, then what is required to justify yourself is not memoirs, but an immediate, bold self-sacrifice. At a debate, a public argument, court-martial, 10 years imprisonment and 5 of disenfranchisement. I.F. Lippi created a collective farm in his own local district a year before the bosses gave orders to create them, a completely voluntary collective farm. And could GPU Commissioner Ovsyannikov allow that hostile sally to go unchallenged? I don't need your good one. Give me my bad one. The collective farm was proclaimed to be Kulak, and Lippi himself an ally of the Kulaks. And they dragged him through the hummocks. F.V. Shavirin, a worker, spoke out loud at a party meeting about Lenin's testament. Well, nothing could be worse than that. He had to be a sworn enemy. Whatever teeth he had managed to keep through the interrogation, he lost in his first year in the Kolyma. See what awful criminals were to be encountered among the 58s. And indeed some were really venomous with a touch of the underground. For example, there was Peretz Gerzenberg, an inhabitant of Riga. All of a sudden he moved to the Lithuanian Socialist Republic and registered himself as being of Polish origin, and in fact he was a Latvian Jew. What was particularly outrageous about this was the desire to deceive his own native state. It meant he was counting on our letting him go to Poland, and from there he would slip off to Israel. Nothing doing, darling. You didn't want to stay in Riga. So, off to Gulag. Betrayal of the motherland via intention, 10 years. And what secretive people there were about, too. In 1937, among the workers of the Bolshevik factory, Leningrad, some former pupils of the trade schools were discovered who had been present in 1929 at a meeting addressed by Zinoviev. A list of those present had been found attached to the minutes. For 8 years, these people had concealed themselves by sneaking into the ranks of the proletariat. Now, all of them were arrested and shot. Said Marx, "The state cripples itself by turning a citizen into a criminal." And very touchingly he explained how in every violator of the law, the state must see a warm-blooded human being as well, and a soldier who defends the fatherland, and a member of the community, and a father of a family, whose existence is sacred, and, most importantly, a citizen. But our jurists have no time to read Marx, particularly such unthought-out parts as these. Let Marx read our instructions if he feels like it. People will exclaim that this whole list is what? Monstrous? Ridiculous? That it is beyond belief? That Europe won't believe it? Europe, of course, won't believe it. Not until Europe itself serves time will she believe it. Europe has believed our glossy magazines and can't get anything else into her head. But what about us? 50 years ago we would not have believed it either for anything. And 100 years ago we would not have believed it. Belinsky, Chernyshevsky, they would not have believed it. But if we dig down 3 or 4 spades deep, back to Peter the Great and before, why shouldn't we believe it? What's so bad about that? It has been going on since time immemorial. The prison watchman Senka spoke. "Don't pull my beard. I'm a peasant who belongs to the state. But does that mean my beard belongs to the state too?" Article 58. Be flogged with cudgels without mercy. The Streltsy junior officer Ivashko Raspopin gestured with his finger and announced, "That's what you can do with your sovereign." 58. To be flogged with cudgels without mercy. The tradesman Blestin, cursing out the Cossacks, said, "The great prince is stupid to give food and drink to you Cossacks." Article 58. To be flogged with cudgels without mercy. The knight, Ivan Pashkov, said, "The sovereign Tsar is higher than St. Athanasius." And the sacristan of the church of St. Athanasius, Nejdan, said, "Then why does the Tsar pray to Athanasius?" This was in Holy Week, and both were drunk. Moscow delivered its verdict without prejudice. The boyar's son must be flogged with cudgels without mercy, and the sacristan flogged for the same reason. These examples are taken from Plekhanov's book, A History of Russian Social Thought. At the very least, everyone keeps his mouth shut, and that is what is needed. In the former Russia, the politicals and the Philistines were two opposite extremes in the population. It was impossible to find more mutually exclusive ways of life and ways of thinking. In the USSR, they began to rake in the Philistines as politicals, and as a result, the politicals were equated with the Philistines. Half the archipelago consisted of the 58s, and there weren't any politicals. If there had been that many real politicals, the government would long since have been sitting on a different bench in the courtroom. Into this Article 58 were thrown all those for whom no criminal article had been chosen right off. It contained an unimaginable medley and motley. For example, a young American who married a Soviet girl and was arrested the first night spent outside the American embassy, Morris Gershman. Or a former Siberian partisan, Muravyov, famous for his reprisals against the whites, vengeance for his brother. Never got out of the GPU from 1930 on. It had begun because of gold. And in the end, he lost his health, his teeth, his mind, and even his name. He became Fox. Or the Soviet quartermaster caught embezzling who fled from criminal prosecution into the western zone of Austria. But when he got there, and here's a laugh, he could not find employment. Stupid bureaucrat that he was, he wanted a high-ranking position there, but how could he get one in a society in which talents compete? So he decided to return to the motherland. Here he received 25 years for the combined offences of theft and suspected espionage. And glad was he. Here he could breathe more freely. Such examples are innumerable. To put a person into 58 was the simplest of all methods of getting rid of him, to remove him quickly and forever. And in addition, just plain family members went into this classification, especially the CHS wives. Today it is well known that the wives of important party leaders were arrested as CHSs, members of families. But this custom had been established earlier. That was how they purged the families of the nobility as well, and the families of prominent intellectuals and clerics. And even in the 50s, the historian K.H. Blank T.S.E.F. received 25 years for committing ideological errors in his book. But shouldn't his wife get her sentence too? 10 years? But why leave out his old mother, age 75, and his 16-year-old daughter? Both got sentences for failure to inform on him, and all four were sent off to different camps without the right to correspond with one another. And the more peaceful, quiet, and even illiterate people, remote from politics, the more people occupied only with their own daily round before their arrest, who were drawn into the maelstrom of undeserved punishment and death, the more grey and timid became Article 58. Stripped gradually of its last political sense, it turned into a lost herd of lost people. But it isn't enough to say who made up Article 58. It is more important to know how the 58th were treated in camp. From the first years of the revolution on, this group was cut off on all sides, by the prison regimen and by juridical formulations. If we take Cheka Order No. 10 of January the 8th, 1921, we learn there that only a worker or a peasant could not be arrested without convincing proofs, which means that an intellectual could be, say, just out of antipathy. Or, if we listen to Krylenko at the 5th Congress of Justice Workers in 1924, we learn that, in regard to convicted hostile class elements, correction is impotent and purposeless. At the beginning of the 30s, they remind us once more that shortening the terms of hostile class elements is a right opportunist practice. And it is also an opportunist directive that held that in prison all are equal, that from the moment of sentencing the class struggle somehow ceases to exist, that the class enemy is beginning to be corrected. If we pull all of that together, then here's what. You can be arrested for nothing, and it is purposeless to try to correct you. And in camp, we will put you in an oppressed position and finish you off there with class struggle. But how are we to understand that the class struggle continues even in camp? After all, it's true, isn't it, that all prisoners are sort of equal? But no, don't be in such a hurry. That's a bourgeois concept. The whole reason they deprived the politicals of the right to be held apart from the non-political criminals was so as to have the criminals on their backs. This was devised, too, by people who had come to understand in Tsarist prisons the strength of possible political unity, of political protest, and its dangers for the regime. Yes, here is Averbach, Johnny on the spot again, to explain to us. The tactic of re-education is based on class differentiation, is based on the strata friendliest to the proletariat. And who are these friendly prisoners? They are former workers, that is, thieves, and they are the ones to be sicked on the 58s. Re-education is impossible without kindling political passions. And this is a literal quotation. And so when our lives were put wholly in the power of the thieves, this was no simple caprice on the part of lazy chiefs in remote camps. It was the exalted theory. The class-differentiated approach to the regimen, incessant administrative pressure on hostile class elements. Yes, dragging out your endless sentence in your tattered, padded jacket with head bowed. Can you even imagine this? Incessant administrative pressure on you? And we can even read in that same remarkable book a list of methods for creating unbearable conditions for the 58s in camp. All you have to do, it says, is reduce the number of visits, parcels, correspondence, the right to complain, the right to move about within the camp. And it says you have to create separate brigades of the hostile class elements and put them in more difficult situations. I elucidate on my own. This means cheat them in measuring the work performed. And then, when they fail to fulfill the norm, declare this to be a sally of the class enemy. Hence the Colima executions of entire brigades. And then it gives frequent creative advice. The kulaks and their supporters, that is, the best peasants imprisoned in the camp, those who even in their dreams used to yearn for peasants' work, were not to be assigned to agricultural work. And it also says the highly skilled hostile class element, in other words, the engineers, were not to be entrusted with any responsible work without a preliminary verification. But who is there in the camp sufficiently qualified to verify the engineers? Evidently the thieves' light cavalry from the cultural and educational section, something like the Chinese Communist Red Guards. It was difficult to act on this advice on the canals. After all, locks do not design themselves. The canal doesn't dig itself. So then Averbach simply begged, let the specialists spend their first 6 months in camp at least on general work. That's all it took to die. In that case, presumably, through not living in a privileged intellectual barracks, they will experience the pressure of the collective. The counter-revolutionaries will see that the masses are against them and despise them. And how convenient it is, having mastered class ideology, to turn everything that takes place inside out. What if someone fixes up former top people and intellectuals with trusty jobs? Then it goes without saying that he is giving the heaviest work to inmates from among the working class. What if a former officer is working in the storeroom and there isn't enough clothing? Then it goes without saying that he is deliberately holding it back. What if someone says to the shock work record holders, the others are not keeping pace with you? Then it goes without saying that he is a class enemy. What if a thief gets drunk or escapes or steals? Then explain to him that it was not he who was guilty, that it was the class enemy who made him drunk or taught him to escape or taught him to steal. an intellectual teaching a thief how to steal. And this was written quite seriously in 1936. And if the hostile element itself is turning in good work performances, he is doing this for purposes of camouflage. The circle is closed. Whether you work or whether you don't, whether you love us or whether you don't, we hate you and will annihilate you with the hands of the thieves. And so it is that Pyotr Nikolaevich Ptitsin, imprisoned as a 58, sighs, "Well, you see, the real criminals are incapable of genuine labor. It is actually the innocent person who sacrifices himself totally to the last breath. There is the drama. The enemy of the people is the friend of the people. But nobody needs your sacrifice. An innocent person. That is the main sensation of those ersatz politicals rounded up and put into camps. In all probability, this was an unprecedented event in world prison history, when millions of prisoners realize that they are right, all of them right, and that no one is guilty. Only one innocent was imprisoned at hard labor with Dostoevsky. However, these crowds of chance people, chased behind barbed wire, not in conformity with their convictions, but by a thrust of fate, were by no means strengthened by the consciousness of their own rightness. Perhaps it even oppressed them more by emphasizing the absurdity of their situation. Clinging more to their former way of life than to any convictions whatever, they in no way manifested readiness for sacrifice, unity, or fighting spirit. While still in prison, entire cells allowed themselves to be plundered by two or three snotty thieves. By the time they got to the camps, they were already totally demoralized. All they were prepared to do was to bend their backs beneath the cudgels of the worker signer and the thief, beneath the fist of the brigadier, and all they remained capable of was mastering the camp philosophy: disunity, everyone for himself, and mutual deceit, and the camp language. When she arrived in a general camp in 1938, why, Olitskaya looked on all those 58s with astonishment, with the eyes of a socialist who had known Solovki and the isolators. Once, in her own recollection, the politicals shared everything, but now each one lived and chewed only for himself, and even the politicals traded clothes and rations. Political riffraff, that's what Anna Skripnikova called them, us. Back in 1925, she herself had learned that lesson. She complained to the interrogator that her cellmates were being dragged by their hair by the Lubyanka prison chief. The interrogator laughed and asked her, "Is he dragging you too?" "No, but my comrades." And he exclaimed in deadly earnest, "Aha, how frightening it is that you protest. Drop all those useless airs of the Russian intelligentsia. They are out of date. Worry about yourself only, otherwise you're in for a hard time." And this is exactly the thieves' principle. If they're not raking you in, then don't lie down and ask for it. The Lubyanka interrogator in 1925 already possessed the thieves' philosophy. And so to the question which sounds so outlandish to the educated public: can a political steal? We simply have to counter with astonishment. And why not? Is he capable of informing? What makes him any worse than the others? And when people naively protest to me about Ivan Denisovich, "How is it that the politicals in your book express themselves in thieves' jargon?" I have to reply, "And what if there is no other language in the archipelago? Do you really expect political riffraff to counterpose a language of their own to that of the criminal riffraff?" They drum into them day and night that they are criminals, and the most heinous of all criminals, and that those who are not criminals are not imprisoned in our country. They broke the back of the 58s, and there were no politicals. Having poured them into the pig's trough of the archipelago, they drove them to die at work and shouted into their ears the camp lie that each was an enemy of the other. The proverb says, "When hunger takes hold, the voice will appear." But among us, among our natives, it did not, even from hunger. And yet how little, how very little, they needed to be saved. Just one thing, not to cling to life, which was already lost anyway, and to rally together. This took place with success sometime among entire foreign groups, for example, the Japanese. In 1947, at Revuchi, the penalty camp for the Krasnoyarsk camps, they brought in about 40 Japanese officers, so-called war criminals, though one could not even imagine what they were guilty of in relation to us.
This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette.